And this is John Richardson. I'm speaking here with Jimmy Sexton of the Esquire Group. Today is Monday, December the 13th. And, you know, we just started an interesting discussion. I guess the theme of it is how, you know, the subpart F regime applies to many more individuals than multinationals, and how things that can benefit multinationals can be absolutely devastating to individuals. So, hadn't planned this, but it was such an interesting discussion that we thought we'd record it for posterity. So, Jimmy, how are you today?
Doing fantastic.
You know, I can't believe this. You know, the world goes on. I bet you that we're the only two people in the world at this moment on December the 13th who are talking about the transition tax. What do you think? You think that's a fair bet?
I mean, I think it's a pretty fair bet. There might be a couple of people out there realizing how bad they screwed it up and they need to amend their tax returns to fix it. But we're probably the only ones having a philosophical discussion about it.
Oh, my God. I mean, what does that say something about us or about the rest of the world?
Well, it means that we're super exciting people, John.
All right. Well, I must say that the discussion is hugely interesting. So, you know, I thought your perspective on, actually, you know what, let's back up. This is now so old that probably a lot of people don't even know about it. But so tell me, you want to just kind of summarize what the transition tax was?
Well, the transition tax was part of the, you know, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. And essentially it was a tax on the undistributed deferred foreign earnings and profits of companies, right? So typical example was Apple, that had all these profits that had not been repatriated to the United States and were being held overseas and were therefore deferred of U.S. income tax.
So, but these to be clear, these would have been held inside a controlled foreign corporation, a CFC, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Can you give you know, people are always excited by numbers, what it means. Can you put some numbers in that to give a sense of the magnitude?
Well, I mean, I don't remember like what the exact number was, but you know, I think Apple had some.
Was it billions of dollars?
Oh, I mean, it could have been trillions. I mean, I think Apple alone had like 90 or 100 billion or something.
That's incredible.
That was being deferred from U.S. tax.
And so the moral of the story is buy these companies when they're on the verge of bankruptcy and wait. Can you imagine if you bought Apple stock in the 80s?
Oh, my God. You'd be retired.
Absolutely. Without, you know, I don't know. I mean, do you get the feeling some days that you'd be better off not working and just, you know, doing something else like managing investments? I mean, do you find that your tax practice interferes with your ability to make money yourself?
Well, it's an interesting question, you know. You know, I find myself pulling back from the tax practice more and more to do exactly that, to focus on investments and different, you know, business deals I'm involved in. Because it's a lot of fun and not as much work.
Yeah, there's no question about that. But yeah, I mean, I have on occasion, you know, work with people on expatriation, you know, that have these huge assets, you know, and Apple stock is one of them. You know, I mean, they never did anything really. I mean, they worked for a year for Apple, you know, or something like this. And
no, I mean, look,
they're definitely covered expatriates.
I mean, listen, I've worked with several people that, yeah, exactly, that worked for startups, and got stock options. And then basically, like, as soon as the company IPO, they've just kind of been retired ever since.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, Apple did well, made a ton of money. And, you know, as a testament to it, I'm actually conducting this call with an Apple computer.
It's a great company, man. It's such a financial powerhouse. Not just because of its hardware, but, you know, it's Apple Pay and all these subscription services and
yep. Yep, the News Plus thing. I mean, you can get a, you can actually, I mean, it's not quite as good, but what's interesting is you subscribe to News Plus. For example, the Toronto Globe and Mail, which is the paper I read. You know, you can pay the Globe for it, or you can, you know, get a slightly watered down version with Apple News, but it's, it, you know, for roughly the same price, right?
Yeah, plus you get a lot more stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's very interesting how.
But going back to the transition tax, it was basically, it was a deemed a tax on these profits, these overseas profits. If I recall, it was like 5.5% on hard assets and 8% on cash or something like that, which really, if you're a multinational, is kind of a gift, right? I mean, at the time, the corporate tax rate was 35%. So if you brought $100 billion home, you got a $35 billion tax hit. Maybe that's reduced a little bit by foreign tax credits. But a lot of these multinationals, you know, if you figure $100 billion overseas, you pay 8%. It's $8 billion. And you get to offset that with foreign tax credits. So if your global effective tax rate before that was, you know, 3 or 4%, it means you already paid $3 or $4 billion. You pay another $4 billion. In tax, and you have your other $92 billion, you know, cleaned, that can be brought back to the U.S. tax-free. I mean, for multinationals, I think the transition tax was really a gift for, you know, self-employed people and people owning small companies overseas. It was a nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the interesting thing. I mean, I liked your phrase earlier, sort of a cleaning or cleansing provision for the multinationals. I mean, that's exactly right. The, you know, once they say, well, you know, you can pay a tax on it now, even though it hasn't been distributed, you know, when you bring it back, whatever, there's going to be no further tax. You know, plus you got the 8-year deferral, right, on the payout, et cetera. And, you know, put it this way, even if they didn't like it, it didn't have the devastating effect that it had on individuals.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it didn't. Look, most of these big international tax rules were written with the assistance and input of the big multinationals and the big four and all the big law firms, which is why, you know, when you read through these tax laws, it's like, okay, the rule is this, but there's all of these exceptions, which many of them don't make sense other than they're beneficial to one or a handful of large multinationals, because they're the only ones that can really take advantage of them a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, it's interesting how the 962 election, for example, had to be put into the code specifically because it wasn't available to individuals.
Yes. And I think what's interesting, and I don't remember if you ever caught this, but there was an article, I don't remember what newspaper it is, but it was a big one of the big papers that came out a little bit after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017 that passed all this. And it had basically shown that the Treasury Secretary had met with the CEOs, or very high-level officials, of basically every big multinational in the United States in the 2 weeks leading up to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And so I'm quite convinced those meetings were them giving their input on how to write this thing and how it should work.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And of course, the lowering of the tax rates from 35 to 21 was, you know, a way to mitigate the effects of the GILTI thing, I suppose. But, you know, the main point here is that for individuals, the transition tax, at least in Canada, right, you know, effectively confiscated people's pensions because people used small business corporations as pension substitutes.
Well, yeah, I mean, the same thing happened a lot within Europe, right? Because in Europe, you have a lower corporate tax rate than the individual tax rate. So people would often accumulate their earnings and profits, not take it out of their companies, because there would be another tax when they took it out.
Yeah. Well, and of course, it really, you know, this whole thing really exacerbates the negative effects of citizenship taxation, right? Because you've got all these, you know, Americans abroad, they don't see themselves having control of foreign corporations. I mean, these are just, you know, mechanisms they use to keep the business where they are.
These are normal people trying to open up a, you know, a donut shop, you know, and just in another country. I mean, small businesses, consulting businesses, marketing companies, everything.
Yeah, yeah, amazing stuff, isn't it?
I mean, when you talk about all this international tax stuff, you know, did you see this recent announcement from the OECD? I forget if it was the end of last week or over the weekend, where you know, obviously they're really proud of themselves for their new global minimum tax and this big global tax deal they're doing. But now they want to start tackling the issue of billionaires. And so I remember when I heard about this global minimum tax for corporations, the first thing that came to my mind is there's going to be a global minimum tax for individuals soon.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now that they want to tackle billionaires, I mean, you just the writing's on the wall. It's just gonna.
Well, the only, you know, I think what people need to invest in is in themselves and their ability to live on small amounts of money and be happy. Because otherwise, you know, there's no question that these countries are gonna. Well, at least, you know, the Western democracies are clearly trying to confiscate the assets of the wealthy. I mean, that's just what happens when more people vote for a living than work for a living. But what this does do is it provides an opening, you know, I think for developing countries and countries that don't, you know, really sign on to this, you know, to start a cycle where prosperity, wealth accumulation is possible again. And, you know, I think probably, you know, we should move into the podcast about Charles Adams' book. But yeah. I think what this really underscores, I mean, we are, so Hillary Clinton, who wrote a book, Living History or something like that, we are clearly living tax history right now.
Oh, for sure.
You know, with the use of the tax systems to, you know, completely change, you know, change civilization. It's going to change social orders. It's going to change everything.
No, I mean, it already is, right? I mean, it's basically, if you want to try to retain any wealth, it's become about mobility, right? If you want to live your nice life that you're used to in the country where you're from, be ready to give up your wealth. If you want to be able to keep it, you've got to move someplace like where I live in Dubai, where wealth is welcome, celebrated, encouraged.
I mean, you know, you talk like that. I mean, I've been to Dubai, but you talk like that. And here I am sitting in Toronto, Canada, where, you know, the top tax rates are now above 50%. And I think, can you imagine, you know, at relatively low levels of income in every province? But here's the thing. That's not worse than New York and California, you know, when you take the federal tax, the state taxes, and all the other junk.
And at least in Canada, you get some pension and health care benefits.
You get health care benefits. And I think the U.S. Social Security benefits are generally better than Canada pension. But there are health care benefits. Yeah. And, you know, and that's huge. But. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about the U.S., and I think it would be unfair to leave out countries like Canada. All these Western democracies are fundamentally pulling in the same direction.
Well,
they're all, you know, part of the, what's that word? The rowing. Okay, they're all rowing together.
I mean, you know what I think? After, you know, I remember growing up in the States, you know, I was always taught that, you know, democracy. Democracy, it's the best. We need to spread freedom. But you know what? Freedom and democracy are not the same thing.
Absolutely, they're not the same
thing. They're sold as a package deal, but they absolutely are not. I feel much more free here in Dubai than I do when I'm in the United States. And I would also say that democracy has proven that it's just as broken as communism or anything else. I mean, I'm convinced that a monarchy with a good monarch is the only form of government that actually works.
You know, Jimmy, that is a really interesting and refreshing thing that you say, because, you know, for years I've been conscious of the fact that democracy and freedom, not only are they not the same, but in many ways they're, depending on the democracy, almost incompatible. Because, you know, if you start from the premise that, you know, the power, that government is essentially a coercive force, right? And, you know, we talk about a democracy, a monarchy, or a communist system, what have you, we're really talking about not whether government is a coercive force, but how, what is the mechanism for the powers of coercion, you know, to be played out. And the reason that we have, you know, constitutional rights, right, or international human rights, is actually because of democracy and because of the ability of, you know, a majority in a democracy to, you know, do horrible things to a minority. And that's why the human rights that are generally specified are just sort of agreed areas where the majority cannot inflict its will on the minority anymore. You know, things like freedom of religion, or, you know, concepts of equal protection, you know, whatever that's supposed to mean. You know, but I mean, it's just, you know, that's, I mean, that's what it is, its core, right? I think just an agreement that, hey, all right, so democracy or whatever, okay, but there are limits, right? So, you know, presumably a limitation on it. And this is, you know, to me, when I started, you know, I first realized this, you know, it was essentially a great revelation, because like you, you know, I grew up hearing these, you know, these slogans, right, these buzzwords, you know, freedom and democracy, you know, whatever that's supposed to mean. You know, it reminds me, as we talk about this, we go back to Kennedy's 1960, I guess it was 62, Berlin speech, where he says something like, freedom has many difficulties, and something like democracy is not. In other words, he separated them. He actually separated.
Wow, wow.
I mean, I strongly urge you, since you're interested in this, it's a powerful, powerful speech. Frankly, okay. I think it was Kennedy's, or rather, who was the speechwriter? Sorensen.
Okay.
Sorensen's best speech ever. And But what's amazing about it is that Kennedy, President Kennedy himself, distinguishes freedom and democracy right there in that speech.
Okay.
And, you know, I think if in school, you know, instead of, you know, focusing on ask not what your country can do, ask what you can do for your country, I think if there were more of a focus on freedom has many difficulties and democracy is not whatever, I think that might be a better education for people.
For sure. You know, it's funny, because I've often told people that I feel more free in Dubai than I do when I'm in the United States. And people, you know, a lot of people don't agree. They think I'm crazy in saying that. And I say, you know, it's not always about the laws that exist. It's also about the way that they're applied, which in the United States' case, they apply the laws in ways that they were never intended to be applied. And they're constantly stripping you of your liberty. And it reminds me of one of the lessons from Charles Adams' book that we went through recently. And I want to find it and read it to you really quick. whatever is taxed must be surveyed. Consequently, if a tax system is all-encompassing, liberty must give way. And because we don't have any income tax and not everything's being assessed here, we're not constantly being surveyed and scrutinized, so we have a lot of freedom. Whereas in the United States, it's the exact, and most other Western democracies, liberty has just given way to such a degree because of the collection of taxation that you're less free in the democratic world than you are in monarchies.
You know, I think that there's a great deal of truth to that. And as I've said before, and people think I'm exaggerating, but I think that you perhaps might appreciate this statement, whether you fully agree with me or not. But I think that in Western democracies, the tax codes have become a constitution of the country.
Yes, I agree completely. You
know, everything gives way to the tax code.
Yep.
And that has got to be
the most important legislation, or the most influential and impactful legislation of the land.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying there hasn't been, but, you know, every time I've found myself involved in this kind of discussion, you say, well, you know, you look at something like FACA, for example, right, that, you know, or citizenship taxation, these are things that discriminate, you know, against people in certain ways. You say, well, you know, doesn't this violate the Constitution? So, but, you know, and the response is generally, well, but this is a tax law, you know, or something of that nature. And, you know, without fully explaining, giving all these reasons. And then the problem of challenging FACA, for example, although this hearing was postponed, it was supposed to be going on today. I'm part of what's called the Alliance for the Defense of Canadian Sovereignty that is challenging the FATCA IGA in the federal court. It's gone to the Federal Court of Appeal in Canada now. But you know, I've been involved in this now since 2014. And, you know, the hardest part of managing to, well, manage this lawsuit is the fact that it's understood that it takes place in the context of taxation and information exchange, and it's hard to get anybody's attention for that reason. You know, which is of course the problem. But you know, I really think that when history is written on this, that the you know the tax codes are going to be seen as instrumental and, you know, effectively ending these civilizations as they are now. And I think that the tax codes are a particularly good example of the conflict between freedom and democracy. So you tell me now, why do you think, I mean, this is a very simple concept. How do I know it's simple? Because I understand it so easily, okay? You know, I'm proud of my simple-mindedness, Jimmy. But surely there must be a lot of people in the world as simple-minded as I am. I mean, why do they have trouble understand, you know, they equate freedom and democracy as though these are the same thing?
Well, I mean, I think it's emotionally, right? I think it's a programmed response. And especially in countries like the United States, I mean, to question it out loud, you're almost viewed as unpatriotic, as it's treasonous to even question this. And I think that most of it just has to do with programming. I mean, I've gone to school in different countries, in three different countries. I've gone to elementary school, and the United States is the only one where you have to pledge your allegiance to the flag. I mean, they indoctrinate you from a very young age. And I think to question that freedom and democracy is very taboo. And people just don't even want to admit to thinking about it. It's just sort of a don't go there type of thing.
You know, I just pulled up on YouTube this speech. Why don't we put in the first 2 minutes of it, okay? Which I think, you know, where he actually makes this distinction. I don't know how well this will work, but let me see if we can do this, okay? I've got it on another computer here.
The walls separated more than a city. It separated the world. On one side lived people who were free to be Christians or Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, or Confucians. On the other side lived people whose expression of any religion was discouraged or taken away. On June the 26th, a short distance from the wall and overlooking the east, the people of West Berlin welcomed a visitor, the President of the United States of America.
There are many people in the world who really don't understand, or say they don't, what is the great issue between the free world and the communist world. Let them come to Berlin. There are some who say that communism is the wave of the future. Let them come to Berlin. And there are even a few who say that it's true that communism is an evil system, but it permits us to make economic progress. Lass sie nach Berlin kommen. Let them come. Freedom has many difficulties. And democracy is not perfect. But we have never had to put a wall up to keep our people in, to prevent them from leaving us. While the wall is the most obvious and vivid demonstration of the failures of the communist system, for all the world to see, we take no satisfaction in it. For it is, as your mayor has said, an offense not only against history, but an offense against humanity, separating families, dividing husbands and wives and brothers and sisters, and dividing up people who wish to be joined together. Freedom is indivisible. And when one man is enslaved, all are not free. All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
So I'll tell you the biggest thing that I took out of that, which was, he says that we've never had to wreck the wall to keep our people in.
We've never had to put up a wall to keep our people from leaving.
Well, but haven't they put up intangible walls via exit taxes?
No question about it. There's no question about it.
Well, I mean, I don't know what the tax code was in 62 in any of the countries, and if they had exit taxes or they didn't. But I would argue that the walls have been put up in Western, and I would argue that the walls have only been put up in Western democracies. I'm only familiar with exit taxes from Western democracy countries.
Yeah, or countries influenced by the U.S. tax code, like Japan. No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And by the way, as I sit here talking to you in Canada, Canada pioneered this damn thing, right?
Yeah.
It was the first.
I don't know they pioneered it, but I know you guys have an exit tax.
And the United States made it far more brutal. But, you know, that is absolutely correct, that they are putting up walls to keep people in. There's no question about it. And U.S. citizenship taxation is clearly one of them.
Yeah.
By, you know, not letting, this is why they're, you know, people are renouncing, right? And they can't survive outside the United States because of this, this, you know, imposing a, you know, what really is a separate and more punitive taxation on Americans abroad than on, you know, American residents, and they try to renounce, you know, they hit them up with an exit tax. I mean, this is unbelievable stuff.
Yep.
But I think it also shows you how, you know, you listen to that speech, which was, you know, in my opinion, really one of the great political speeches of all time. I mean, it's really hard to find a, I mean, even Reagan, who was generally a better speaker, his Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall, you know, and whatever that was, 80 in the eight, later in the 80s, was not, you know, on a par with that speech. But you listen to that, right? He talks about keeping people in, freedom versus democracy, you know. And then we look at the whole tax system, you know, through this, and we see so many of the problems, right? And they're definitely exacerbated by sort of excluding basic constitutional and human rights from the purview of tax legislation.
Yeah, look at passport revocations.
Exactly. You know, which really needs to be understood is you can't leave the country.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is, I mean, this is really amazing stuff. And, you know, it's completely invisible. I mean, the genesis, and what's interesting about it is, right, you talk about freedom, you know, the genesis of the exit taxes was actually 1966 in the United States. And by the way, there was no announcement in the elementary schools. Okay, you know, that today Congress, you know, planted the seeds of what will become the exit tax. And what it was really about was, you know, trying to provide or allow tax incentives for non-resident aliens to invest in the United States. And the beginning of the exit tax rules was to punish people who would say, hey, I wish I were a non-resident alien too, right?
Yeah. Well, no, you know, listen, I've often told people, explained people the differences of how you're taxed when doing business or investing in the United States as a foreigner versus a U.S. person.
Far better.
And people are just flabbergasted. I mean, they're astounded because the U.S. set itself up to be just exploited and pillaged by foreign investment with very little taxation. But if you're an American, you cannot take advantage of that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, so you say, well, you know, I'm a citizen. I mean, shouldn't I matter? Why should somebody who's a non-citizen not have a better deal than I do? I don't understand this. I mean, I can really understand the, you know, I can understand the emotional appeal to that. You know, I also understand, you know, the desire to attract foreign capital to these countries.
Well, I mean, this is what I was going to say. I mean, from a standpoint of attracting foreign capital, it was absolutely a brilliant political and economic move, right? I mean, I think it's, what, 35% of the stock market is foreign owned. You know, you've created a culture where, you know, real estate in Los Angeles and New York are basically viewed as stable as gold. I mean, they just never go down in value. I mean, it's done incredible things for the United States. I think it's one of the contributing factors to the U.S. being the world's biggest superpower and biggest economy. I mean, it was brilliant, but very unfair to U.S. citizens.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, there is no tax code that is more unfair to citizens than the U.S. code. I mean, just because of citizenship taxation. I think that's simply established. And the only person who would not understand that would be somebody in the United States who'd never thought about it or didn't understand it. But
yep.
If you do understand, I mean, I think that's fairly obvious.
Just impact such a small amount of people that generally they're ignored.
Yeah, and you know, back to your point on, you know, is democracy, I mean, you know, sure, we can take Winston Churchill's democracy as the worst form of government, except for all the other forms of government. I mean, okay. But, you know, that doesn't tell us, you know, whether it really is preferential or not, or why. And, you know, you're in Dubai. I was in Dubai a couple of years ago for a conference. And, you know, the person introducing the conference was, you know, some political figure in Dubai, and made the point saying, you know, I mean, people sometimes complain about Dubai not being a democracy, but you look at, say, the United States, where 51% of the people can inflict their will on 49%. And he said, you know, I mean, what kind of democracy is that, right? You know, and I think there's a great deal of truth on that, in that. And you look at what's happening in Western democracies, Canada, the United States, where, you know, the political parties have managed to co-opt the democratic process, right? If you're not a member of main political party, you know, you really have no say. And then what has happened is that, particularly in the United States, where the purpose of politics now seems to be for the political parties to wage war against each other, you know, completely ignoring, you know, the effects of this stuff on the individuals. So, you know, I think in theory, democracy's probably better. But for a democracy to function, it has to mean a lot more than just people can vote. You know, it has to mean that they have some kind of, you know, meaningful.
Well, you know, like I've said before, you know, the only kind of democracy that I think works is a direct democracy.
How do you manage? Yeah. So how do you manage? So by direct democracy, you're meaning everybody gets a vote and everybody's vote counts, right?
Yep. Okay. Because where you get screwed is the middlemen, right? It's like, I mean, look at any process, right? I mean, whether it's in business or in politics, it's the middleman that screws it all up, right? Because he's got his own interests. He's basically, you know, useless a lot of times. You know, you usually started out with some type of purpose, but I mean, look at all the disruption that's happened in business, where middlemen have been cut out because of, through technology, they've made the process more efficient and it works better because these middlemen bloated prices, you know, by charging commissions. And that's basically what we have in the political system, is we got all these senators and congressmen or, you know, cabinet or, you know, people or members of parliament or whatever, in whatever countries. And they've made themselves so important and taken the will of the people away.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question. There's no question. I mean, we talk, you know, to go back to where we started this thing, you know, we talk about the makings of the transition tax and that. And you make the point that, you know, so the treasurer, who was that, Mnuchin at the time? Mnuchin? Steve Mnuchin, is that his name? You know, at the time was, you know, having discussions with, you know, the multinationals. And yeah, I mean, you know, you see that at work. And, you know, when interestingly, the vast majority of people affected were not multinationals at all, right?
I mean, the transition tax never would have existed in a direct democracy. It would have either been a much bigger amount of money, or it would have never come to be in the first place.
Well, I think that's right, because it would have been decided based on the principle of whether that kind of tax was reasonable or not, and not sort of a political expediency. But let me ask you a question about the direct democracy thing, okay? Because this is something I've often wondered about and thought about, so you bring it up. So, you know, it has the allure of, you know, everybody votes, everybody's vote counts. You just add up the total number of votes. How do you handle the problem that, you know, then 51% of people could inflict their will on 49%? I mean, would you still want to have, you know, constitutional restrictions on what government could do in certain key areas, you know, religion, speech, and stuff like that? Or would you want to?
I still think that you need a basic constitution, establishing certain freedoms that cannot be changed.
Well, what do you think those freedoms are? I mean, I'm genuinely interested. you know, because
this is an interesting conversation that I did not prepare for.
No, nor did I. But that's okay. That's okay.
I think both you and I
are very good. At least I'm very good at talking about things I don't know anything about. Okay.
Look, I think if you look at it on its face, I think the U.S. Constitution was a very good base. The problem is it's just been so distorted and overinterpreted to the will of judges who are political appointees that you can't even recognize it anymore. I think the freedom of movement, the freedom of religion, the freedom of against unreasonable searches and seizures, due process. I think these are all very, very good basic rights.
Yeah, and you look at. So I don't know if you want to use, I suppose, a starting point. The U.S. Constitution is very old, and the Bill of Rights was, what, in the 1800s or whatever?
Yeah.
Let's move over to, say, Canada, South Africa, I think are countries who sort of more recently, in the case of Canada, at least in the 80s, dealt with the question of, what should be in a Charter of Rights. And I agree with you, there's a lot of overlap. I mean, there's equality, there's procedural rights, et cetera. So it seems to me you have to have those, but then we have the problem of there being politicized, where I think the U.S. is probably, well, no, Canada too. I mean, let me ask you this question, okay? Before we've talked about the issue of who should make tax laws, and I think we both agree that it's too complex and important to be left to Congress to do that, okay? Or at least a partisan kind of Congress.
Yeah.
What about the appointments? So in Canada, Trudeau, essentially appoints, when there's a vacancy in the Supreme Court or whatever, right? They appoint these judges. And same thing is true in the United States, right? It's the executive branch that appoints these judges. My own view of this is that there ought to be better control over the appointment of judges because whoever can appoint judges can ensure that their political legacy lasts way, way beyond, their time in office, right?
For sure. And, going back to what you were saying about writing tax laws, I was going to say the only people that should be able to write tax laws are people that have a PhD in Charles Adams' book and understand the history of taxation and its impact on civilization.
I think that's right, and people who are committed to the principle that people ought to be able to understand what's expected of them. And I would add this, that I think that all laws, see, the way they make these laws is, there's a bunch of, they say, they're going to change this section of the code to say this, and here's a bunch of amendments, and nobody even understands what it is. What they need to do, at a bare minimum, and this is not sufficient, but at a bare minimum, they should publish exactly what the tax code looks like after the amendments. So you don't need $1,000 an hour lawyer to attempt to figure it out for you.
Well, wait.
That's what you do, of course.
No. It's actually funny because, people often ask me, in these types of conversations where I'm so against taxation, they often ask me, wouldn't it put you out of a job? And I say, I would happily do something else to not live in a world with this oppressive taxation. I'm a smart guy. I'll figure it out.
I think that's exactly right. And there are more and more, I know a lot of people who are, sort of tax professionals in some form or another, right? And more and more of them in conversation, I find, would say exactly the same thing. Partly for, reasons of principle, but also partly for reasons they realize it takes up too much of their time and they could actually be, doing much better and have, more money, having happier lives elsewhere, et cetera.
And the thing is, I mean, I do enjoy the study of taxes and the tax laws, especially finding out ways to beat the government at their own game. But the problem with it is, like, you never, your clients are always pissed off that they got to deal with taxes to begin with, right?
Yeah. Well, in an environment where they can't understand it. And, you know, like, as I've said before, possibly in our podcast, you know, it's almost as though the tax code has become so complicated, nobody understands. It's sort of like, you know, the Catholic Church in the 1500s, whatever, you know, the only way to talk to God was through the priests, whatever, the organized church. And it's reached the point now where the Internal Revenue Code is the new religion. The only way to talk to them is through the tax professionals, right? So now, you know, we have different cat. We have, you know, we have bishops, you know, we have cardinals, you know, the tax world, et cetera. And it's just crazy. No. I mean, at a bare minimum, when it comes to taxation, I really think that people ought to be able to understand what's expected of them.
No, I mean, I think this is true of all laws. People ought to understand what's expected of them, you know?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, this has been an unexpected detour today, but it is 9 o'clock. So why don't we make this our podcast for the week, which I think is actually a very interesting one.
Yeah, cool.
All right. You want to give your coordinates in case somebody wants your services there?
You can look me up at esquiregroup.com or send us an email at info@esquiregroup.com.
Yeah, so, you know, Jimmy is the founder and CEO of the Esquire Group and one of the leading tax philosophers of our age.
I think that's we're the top two, John.
The top two tax philosophers of our age. Exactly. Anyway, this has actually been a very, very interesting discussion.
It has been. It's been a lot of fun, as always.
And I thank you for it. And we will pick up again next week. So have a you're on the way to the evening. What time is it there again?
It's 6 o'clock p.m.
Okay. Oh, you are into the evening. All right. Well, listen, have a great evening. And we will reconvene same time, same channel next Monday.
See you later, John.
Yeah. Bye-bye.